the title. Very interesting, thought-provoking. How did you come across that one?
I am a big letter writer. I write a lot of letters and a big Christmas card sender, which I never thought I would be when I was younger. To me, it was kind of like, you know, someday you would say to your friends, we'll just be sending Christmas cards back and forth. Like, this was going to be really sad and pathetic. Like, you know, we're so close now. And that's kind of what's happened to some of my best friends. But I realize there's a real pleasure in that. There's a real pleasure of at least once a year saying, I'm thinking about you. Here's something to kind of make your house look a little beautiful for the holidays. And so I actually really like sending Christmas cards. Right after Thanksgiving, I start to get Christmas cards and start to write letters in them and stuff. So that was part of it.
And when you say write letters, do you mean write letters by hand or emails? Or
mostly I type letters out and I print them and I send them off.
Okay.
You know, hard copy. So you get a letter and you can kind of sit down and look at it and choose when you're going to read it or not. And sometimes this makes my friends nervous because they'll be like, well, I've gotten three letters from you and I haven't sent any back and I owe you. And I say, you know, you don't. Letters are gifts. It took me a long time to realize that writing letters are more for me because I have this kind of monologue to my friends. So it's a way to talk to my friends that I can't see. And here's a letter. I'm thinking about these things. And I don't keep a diary. I don't keep a journal. But I keep letters. And letters kind of record things that I'm doing in my life right then. And I send them off to friends. So that was part of it. And the other part of it was this realization that I've spent my life in books. I've spent my life reading and surrounded by books. And some books I read again and again. And I've spent more time with these characters than I have a lot of people. And I won't say they're very real to me, but they're somewhat real to me. And this idea that, you know, I know Huck and Hamlet better than I do a lot of people in my life. And sometimes I fall away from them and I don't hear from them for a long time. So I had this idea of, you know, what if you write to them? And then I find out that people actually write to Juliet. You know, she gets thousands of letters a year.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they'd say, Juliet, can you give me advice and stuff like this? And so I understand that. I understand kind of feeling so close to a character, you might write them. And for me, it's just the sending Christmas cards is just, I'm touching base. You know, I'm still thinking about you. I'm still here.
The live nature of these characters, or the active nature in your life, it spills out in the first poem in this collection. If librarians were honest, these characters are alive and they can influence you and infect you. And if the librarian was honest, you'd get the straight skinny.
Yeah, the characters are alive. And, you know, we talk about reading. Reading has been my life and living in books. But I'm also somewhat ambivalent about it because it can damage you. There's some negative things that can happen. It can infect you in some ways. Kurt Vonnegut, I think it is, has this great short story where he teaches, you know, adult literacy programs, and then the people he teaches just want to read white supremacist hate literature. And it's like, you know, that's not really what he thought he was doing. I think some stories can damage you in some ways.
There's a dark underbelly of the library trips.
There is, and they don't tell you this. They don't say, you know, this will change your life. So it's mostly good. I love libraries. I think they're the best institution next to the post office kind of invented. But we don't always talk about that other aspect of it, that you'll be changed. You really have to understand that you'll be changed. So
let's dive in with if librarians were honest. You know, warning parents, some of this could be shocking.
Yeah, I was going to ask, should I edit the kind of second stanza out?
No, I think go for the whole thing.
Okay. It starts off with one of my favorite quotations from Benjamin Franklin, who he talked a lot in his autobiography. It's not enough to work hard, but people have to see you working hard. You have to, you know, roll your wheelbarrow through the streets. But he also said sometimes, a book indeed sometimes debauched me from my work. And I love that verb, debauched, and all the kind of erotics of reading. And Franklin was one of the inventors of the first lending library as well. So there's that kind of connection to librarian. If librarians were honest... If librarians were honest, they wouldn't smile or act welcoming. They would say, you need to be careful. Here be monsters. They would say, these rooms house heathens and heretics, murderers and maniacs, the deluded, desperate, and desolate. They would say, these books contain knowledge of death, desire, and decay, betrayal, blood, and more blood. Each is a Pandora's box. So why would you want to open one? They would post danger signs warning that contact might result in mood swings, severe changes in vision, and mind-altering effects. If librarians were honest, they would admit the stacks can be more seductive and shocking than porn. After all, once you've seen a few breasts, vaginas, and penises, more is simply more, a comforting banality. but the shelves of a library contain sensational novelties, a scandalous permissive mingling of Malcolm X, Marx, Melville, Merwin, Millay, Milton, Morrison, and anyone can check them out, taking them home or to some corner where they can be debauched and impregnated with ideas. If librarians were honest, they would say, "No one spends time here without being changed. Maybe you should go home while you still can."
Oh, the power of ideas, the power of knowledge.
Exactly. And once you know something, you can never not know it again. So
I love how you speak to the with that line of where they can be debauched and impregnated with ideas, that just the engagement element you're bringing forth here. It's not a one-sided deal when you pick up a book.
No, it's not. I was thinking a lot about the difference between poems and novels and the shortness of it. And I think the length of a novel versus the shortness of a poem. And poems we kind of consume and we ingest and we take them in. But novels take us in. I mean, we're consumed by these and we spend hours and hours and hours in them. And it's a very intimate relationship. And, you know, we tend to read them, you know, I tend to read them in bed. I tend to read them on couches. We're alone with the book. It's a very personal relationship.
I find, I'm talking about books instead of poetry. I read The Old Man and the Sea in this little cabin up in northern Wisconsin. It was a summer day, but it was like 45 degrees and rainy. I just read the whole thing there by a window. It was just a great experience, and I'll never forget it. So every time I think of that book, I'm right back on that couch.
Yeah, I have the same experience. A lot of times I won't even remember what was in the book, but I will absolutely remember the experience of reading it, where I was, what the smells were, what I was eating, and the kind of time we spent together. And I think that's part of it.
Yeah. When you're this honest, I'm talking about looking at how you raise your kids, looking at, you know, how you deal with the adversities in life. What's the upside? What's the downside of that kind of vulnerability, for the lack of a better way of putting it?
Well, the upside is, you know, the traditional stereotype one, it gives me an outlet. I have a way that I can figure out these experiences and figure out what they mean to me and have a chance to arrange them into something, something that kind of makes sense and has meaning to me. And sometimes I do that, and those poems never go anywhere. They stay in my notebook or go into a drawer, or I work that out and they're done. So that's on one level. And I think it's a way of making sense of the world, you know. The poet Mark Strand said, "I write poetry to prove I was paying attention to this world." And that's one reason I do it as well. I'm making sense. I'm paying attention. It gets you to focus. The downside is, you know, I write a lot about personal things. I write a lot about my family. As soon as my daughter started reading, I had that sense of, oh, she's going to read this stuff someday. You know, how honest do I want to be? And I think I try to be as honest as I can. At some point, you're also transmuting it into hopefully a better work in some way. So it's not a diary entry. It's not just I'm writing down exactly what happens. You know, I can remember a woman coming up to me, and she said a very nice complimentary thing. She said, "Oh, I feel I know you. I feel I know your family." And I knew what she was trying to say, but inside I also wanted to say, you don't. You know the side that I'm presenting here, and you know certain things, and certain things are changed. And so she wanted to say, "I feel like I understand your family. And I understand your work, but there's always things that you're leaving out or not telling."
Sure, sure. I don't want to start off dark upon dark, but transformations, I mean, is a raw look at family life, and maybe do we jump into that?
Transformations, I was actually surprised once I started to read that poem, the response that I was getting from parents who would come up and say, "Oh, I love that poem," especially mother-daughter relationships. And that was a poem that, you know, you work out the kind of honest parenting relationships. I can remember the first time that my daughter was really young. She was maybe one or two. And my wife was holding her, and they were fussing about something. And my daughter bit her. My daughter bit, you know, my wife. She turned to me. She was shocked. She said, "She just bit me." And we couldn't believe this happened. And we went to a friend, and a friend was like, "Yeah, you got to bite her." And just so kind of matter of fact.
You got to bite her.
Like, nobody told us this. Nobody told us kids bit. And so it was like this kind of side of parenting that people were never admitting what happens inside the house that was really revelatory for us. that we don't really talk about. Yeah. You've got to bite her.
Well, how about, can we have a reading from Transformation, and then we'll jump onto something maybe lighter?
Sure.
Because I love the way you get into this discussion of the family dynamic through, of all people, Rapunzel.
Yeah, we end up reading these fairy tales again and again and again, Cinderella or Rapunzel or whoever it may be. And so once you read them 10, 20, 30 times, you really start to kind of think about them and turn them up into the light. And there's all these kind of weird, for me, these weird absences. Like Cinderella is not her name, but we never find out what her name is. And I think that's strange. I think it's strange that the glass slipper doesn't change and everything else changes. So, and you start to see these stories differently in the different kind of perspectives and the other sides, and these stories that are laid on top of stories. And I think we do that with children too. We see, we see ourselves in those children, or we see our ancestors, or you're acting exactly like your grandfather. And there's kind of stories on top of stories, and we're people who are on top of people and other people's stories in some ways.
Yeah, you get kind of locked into that without looking behind the curtain or just accepting there may be a totally different human being there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So this is called Transformations, and the title, Anne Sexton has a wonderful book called Transformations where she's working with fairy tales. And one of the things that I do in the book is I'll quite often allude to other stories and other poems. I'm not trying to say this is absolutely original. In fact, quite the opposite. I'm saying we write stories on top of other stories, and we change them as we go along. So, Transformations. I used to pity Rapunzel, unjustly imprisoned, a victim and symbol of a repressive society that locks women away until they must use the emblems of femininity to try to escape. And then we had children, ones who didn't act like the parenting book suggested they would, who seemed instead to have come from the dark fairy tales, those of the Grimms, not Disney. With little warning, they would transform into various were-beasts, bears, wolves, dogs, or fierce-beaked birds. They barked and bit, howled and hurled whatever came to hand. They were immune to reason, admonitions, pleas, sarcasm, laughter, feigned equanimity. Spanking only annoyed them and made them more ferocious. No hug could last long enough to calm them, and we couldn't find the spell or incantation that would charm them quiet. When they refused to remain in time out, and instead stalked us through the house, snarling, scratching, hitting, and kicking, we locked them away, high in their bedrooms, where they clawed and hammered at the walls. Eventually, they would change back to the form of children and call out for help, telling passers-by they had been cruelly imprisoned, their voices and faces so sweet, even we sometimes believed it. Each story transforms the ones that came before. So now I wonder what Rapunzel might be capable of, and what the castle looks like inside. Are the tower stairs covered with combs, scissors, clothing, ripped paper, whatever she could throw before someone managed to get the door closed? Does the laundry room have a hamper of towels used to wipe the places where she has spat? And in the kitchen, is the trash full of wine bottles, ones shared by Rapunzel's parents late at night, as they talked about what to do, allowing themselves to let their hair down and say horrible things, things they must keep behind locked doors.
Joe, you bring it right down into reality there in the last several lines in a way that it just feels so perfectly natural. But then before you realize it, you're out of Rapunzel land and out of this whole story. And it was a really nice arrival point.
Thank you. You know, a poem should go somewhere. You should travel an arc or a journey or end up somewhere else or for some different perspective, I think. So I'm glad to hear you say that.
So many poems, so little time, Joe, within my five. I was going to jump on to Ode, though. Is that all right with you?
That is fine with me. Okay. Ode is a important poem for me. So
yeah, I've been saying this more and more, I guess, as I get older. It's a cliche. I take time to smell the roses. I get a lot of pleasure out of the little things in life, the things you see every day.
And I think that's, in fact, for me, Ode is an important poem because Ode is kind of the answer to why I write, and this is kind of why I do it. The irony of that is Ode is the kind of poem that I said I would never write when I was younger. You know, the younger me was like, oh, a poem about writing poetry that's so narcissistic, that's so egotistical, I'm never going to do that. just like I was never going to have kids or get married or own a house or have a regular job, and it turns out all those are pretty great, and there's a reason for them. So I found myself writing this poem, and I thought I was just going to put it away, but it turned out I liked it more than I expected to. So this is called Ode. He says, compose an ode, a praise song to something ordinary. And I decide to first write down possible subjects: coffee, donuts, the morning air, the smell of onions and butter frying, the purple hyacinths by the garage, the jeans with the holes in the knees. And I add to the list as I walk around the house, the neighborhood, the day, until I've filled my notebook. So I buy another. And the first thing I write in it is new notebooks and old cashiers who call you honey. And I fill that one, then another, and the sun descends, and I put that in. That takes dozens of pages, as the light seems to change everything. And the sun itself changes as it dissolves against the horizon. Then the gloaming and the thickening darkness. Then the glowing of houses, blue windows, bike lights, fireflies, stars, and smelling somebody's pipe and wood smoke, and hearing voices and cheers from the nearby ball field, and someone's guitar, and drinking wine that was given to you by a friend, and sitting on a screened porch, swinging a pen back and forth, noting as much as you can, and trying to get some of it down, just some of it, before it's too late.
Life is short.
Yes, it is. And you want to pay attention. You want to get some of it down before it's too late, before these things are gone. So,
I like one of the references in there, just grabbed me in terms of how you respond to someone calling you honey, the cashier calling you honey, because that speaks to me, to my own kind of journey in life. Initially, I didn't get that because I didn't know the person, and it made me feel a little uncomfortable. But now I love it. And I don't know what happened between then and now, but it's just kind of this embracing, just comfortable with that little moment and not questioning it so much.
Yeah, and I think, you know, my wife, when she was growing up, spent a lot of time in a small town in England and didn't like it and couldn't wait to get out of it and kind of badmouthed it to me of, oh, I grew up in a small town. And then she took me there, and I loved it. It was totally charming, and because I wasn't from there. I was like, look, there's a British mailbox. Oh, my God, I can't believe it. That's so cool. And I went to a place to get, you know, tea and a pastry or something. And the woman said, you know, that'll be 50p, love. And I thought, oh, she called me love. That's so cool. And my reaction had my wife suddenly see the place differently and say, oh, that's right. That actually is pretty charming. And so when we came back and the waitresses do the same thing, here you go, honey. Here you go, dear. You know, I love that. So, and the younger me would not have loved that.
He says, write this ode. Who is he? Is this you? Is this a father figure? He says, compose an ode.
You know, a lot of times my poems will be about teaching and writing as a student, and my perspective will shift around between being the student and being the teacher. So it could be me. It could be an exercise that I give to my students, and then I put myself in the student and try to see what that feels like. Quite often, I will be multiple people in the poem. Sometimes I'll even be mocking myself in some of these poems. I'll give somebody advice or something that I have been known to say in a classroom, and the reaction against it will be like, you know, you pompous, I can't believe you're saying that. So I'm trying to play with multiple perspectives in these tales and these relationships and these environments. Because really good poems and really good stories, you see them from so many different perspectives. You know, when I was young, Icarus and Daedalus is totally a story about this boy awakening and this learning to fly and not listening to advice. And as I get older, it's a parenting tale. And my views towards these stories shift around. So,
Well, nothing in this book seems to bring that out, that dynamic, that shift of perspective more than Mean, where you're suddenly you're in that classroom seat as the student, and then you're behind the lectern as the teacher in this case. I just found it raw and honest from the student's perspective and from the professor's perspective.
And it took me a long time to get there when I was a student, and I would learn some of these poems or be taught some of these poems, and they just seemed stupid to me. They just seemed, you know, a red wheelbarrow with white chickens. I don't get this. And then as I got older, I started to understand them a little bit more. But you, of course, want the answer. You want somebody to tell you, here's what it means. And I think any good story resists that easy interpretation. It's not a message. It's not an advertisement. It's not a bumper sticker slogan. And so that can cause enormous frustration sometimes.
I had the antithesis of that in my introduction to poetry class. I'm sure I shared this with you before, but it was always little David the freshman at Introduction to Poetry offering his insights in a poem, what he thought it might mean, and the professor saying, oh, no, it's not that at all. No, next. He just browbeating me into submission, and I just gave up. Like for 20 years, I didn't pick up a poem after that. It was just, well, I'm not going to get it anyway.
I hear that experience a lot, and I'm not sure why it happens, but I'll have students who will say, yeah, my professor told me what this means, or my teacher, and they say that, you know, those plums, that's a sexual metaphor. That means sex. And I'm like, yeah, but they use plums in this other poem with this old lady walking down the street. I don't think she's walking down the street having sex. You know, I think you got to be really careful about, here's the interpretation. I'm going to teach it to you, and then this is exactly it, because that may be a possibility. But what that does is a lot of times it kills the poem and the poetry after a while.
Well, one thing that's beyond doubt, though, is that you are mean in this poem.
I am mean. This poem is called Mean. For almost an hour, they've argued about what the poem means. And although they've reached a consensus, treating interpretation as a kind of democratic exercise or statistical problem, now, at the end of class, they turn to me for the answer. They're sure I know. If I say I don't, they won't believe me. And they shouldn't. I do know what the poem means to me today. But I also know that it used to mean something different several years ago when I first read it. Some poems are fish, finning away when you try to grab them. But if you can hook, net, and gut one, you can eat it. Once. Some poems are greased pigs, squirting free, leaving you breathless, dirty, hands on your knees, shaking your head at their dexterity. Some are chameleons, appearing to be whatever you want or need them to be. I could point out a poem is miraculous in its animal shape-shifting, not a statue covered with a tarp to be yanked off at a key moment. I could say it means no more than a tree does, or a sparrow, or a brick. But although this may shift their attention from what the poem means to what I mean, it's the kind of response that makes people say they hate poetry. You want to know what the poem means, I ask? They nod. I understand that, I say, as I close my book and turn away to wipe the board clean. Most grumble, annoyed at this refusal to do my job. Some suspect it's another teacher trick. A few are afraid I'm just being mean. And one girl stares as if I'm an animal who is moving just outside of her reach.
And when you see that long stare, is that a good response? How does that make you feel?
Well, it makes me feel that something is going on under there. And, you know, I think we give course evaluations way too early on the end of the class. Add it up now. Sometimes I haven't realized for years how important a course was. What I kind of learned from it. I think we should go back to students 5-10 years later and say, okay, evaluate these courses now. I didn't get a lot of what was happening in some of my classrooms for years. So I like to see those responses. I like to see somebody kind of considering you, thinking, what exactly what's happening here?
That really speaks to this whole ongoing debate about the value of a liberal arts education in general. I mean, if you don't get that value-added trade skill that's going to put you out in the workforce tomorrow and make six figures, is it worth it? You know, but ultimately, that whole college experience can be something that forms over years and years after graduation, and it turns you into a pretty decent person.
Well, I think you interact with these stories, with these poems, with these books. You don't read them once and say, oh, I've got it. Got the information from there. I'm done. You read them. You have these relationships, and that goes back to the title. You have these ongoing relationships, I think, for years and years. There's poems that I continue to go back to. I'm finding fresh things. I'm seeing them differently. As I age, they change. There's stories I go back to, and you continue to learn from them.
Well, we're talking about the passage of time. You threw in one, for me, a greased pig in this collection, and that was cutting off a toes to try to fit into a slipper. Want to get your perspective on that in Telling Time. But first, I don't find that often in your work, Joe, because I'm just in a first reading oftentimes. I feel like I'm really getting a level of enjoyment out of these poems. I can get deeper and deeper, I'm sure, by reviewing them. But what is it about where you've written something that has a meaning or several meanings to you personally that you know darn well, on a first reading for the average poetry reader, is going to force them to really grapple with that in a way that maybe they don't get it, whatever that means, right away? Your hope is maybe they will get it eventually, or maybe not. That whole thought process from the writer's perspective.
I think it was James Joyce for Finnegan's Wake. Somebody said, you know, it took you 17 years to write it. I think it would take me 17 years to understand it. And he said, well, it would be worth it. Go ahead and do that. I don't have that kind of desire or feeling about my work. I would like you to understand it immediately, but realize that that initial understanding has its pleasures, but it will bear repeated kind of readings as well. I don't want to be obscure. I'm not looking to be something that only a select few can understand. Private kind of meanings. Now, there may be some references that I understand that maybe other people don't get, but I don't think they should be key to the poem. I also don't think the poem should be immediately, I got it once and now I know what that means. I think it should unfold and it should develop, and there should be multiple pleasures as you read through the poem. So you're constantly balancing between, am I being too obscure or am I spelling things out too far? You know, we talked earlier about you engage with books and poems, and the readers bring something to it. They bring their imagination, they bring their understandings, and you want that to happen, I think. You want this multiple engagement back and forth. So I found myself writing a lot of poems about fairy tales. And one of the things I was curious about was, what is the absolute heart or some fairy tales? What are the bones? And I came up with this metaphor of, if you put these fairy tales in a crucible and you melted them down, what would be the elements that were left? I wrote a bunch of these. I wrote a couple dozen, you know, Crucible Snow White. And I just called them all Crucible Blank poems, you know. Crucible Three Little Pigs. Crucible Jack and the Beanstalk. And then as I was shaping them together, I realized, well, maybe this is one longer poem. So there's a poem in here called Crucible, and it has seven sections. And I debated for a long time about whether I would put at the top of each section what fairy tale I was working with. You know, this is Jack and the Beanstalk. This is Three Little Pigs. And eventually I decided not to, because I thought, well, part of the pleasure is figuring that out. And then you think, oh, yeah, I figured that. I know what he's doing. I've kind of cracked it. Now, I didn't want it to be, I've cracked it, I've got it now. But I thought, I didn't need to give you too much information. You can still figure it out, and maybe you won't. And so you're constantly trying to decide, how much do I tell and how much do I not? And I think that's a balance. I fall on the side of making, I think, my poems accessible, because I want them to be read and understood in some ways. On the other side, I think sometimes my work, people think, well, if I can understand it, it must not be poetry, you know. I mean, there's this almost weird thing of, it's not kind of serious poetry if I can get it.
If the bottle of wine's only $8.99, it can't be any good.
Yeah, then it can't be good. There's kind of that experience with it.
Stinky Cheese Man and Fairy Tales, have you read it?
I did a long time ago.
Yeah, that was kind of a titration of fairy tales, but in kind of a prose way. It was a little on the tacky side, but funny. There's definitely some humor in there.
I love telling those kind of multiple stories and those variations as we tell things. And then we have a greater understanding, I think, of the tales themselves. T.S. Eliot said at some point, he said, every work changes the works that came before it. And I absolutely didn't understand what he meant until I read Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. And that changes my understanding of Hamlet. I don't see Hamlet the same way anymore after reading that play. And you go back to these works. Even though Hamlet came first, I understand it differently because of works that came later.
Telling Time, a classic example of this sort of look at these elements in a way that I, you know, through a new lens for me.
Well, again, things of reading these fairy tales, you see all these variations of fairy tales that you're reading to your kids, or your kids are seeing, or that you're even hearing. And again, you're thinking, okay, what is the primary elements of this fairy tale and how is it changing? And we all know a lot of the Disney tales, the Grimm's tales are much darker, and you go back to them. But that doesn't mean I think that they're better, but I think they're emphasizing different things. So as I was thinking about what is the nature of these fairy tales, it seems to me they do have some elements in common. This is called Telling Time. A tale like a rock, over the years becomes smooth from constant rubbing. Edges and corners are brayed until it seems no more than a glossy ornament. But hold it to your ear. You can still hear the ticking within. Whatever gets polished away, the violence we do to one another and ourselves, the cutting off of toes to try to fit into a slipper, the dancing to death in red-hot shoes, the pulling out of tongues, this remains. The clock will strike midnight. The crocodile is near. The last petal is falling. Hurry, each story says. You don't have much time.
And there you go, life short.
Well, that's, you know, people talk about kids of a way to ensure kind of immortality or your future. And as soon as my kids arrived, I felt so mortal. I started to see everything from the future perspective of when I wasn't going to be here anymore. And it really made that sense of the passing of time come feel much quicker.
How long did that last for you, that feeling? Or is it ongoing?
It's still going on. It's still, I keep telling my daughter, you know, stop growing. yeah. And looking at my son, and, you know, he used to not be able to see on the counter, and now he's jumping around and taller. And
how old are the kids now?
My daughter is 9 and my son is 6.
Okay. Yeah, we say we're going to bonsai Rafa, our 7-year-old, and just keep them small.
Yeah, just they're at a good age right now, but they're getting bigger and bigger, and they're getting more interesting. But some things have passed, and you think, okay, that's gone now.
Yeah. The violence we do to one another and ourselves, the cutting off of toes to try to fit into a slipper. I'm picturing the ugly sisters just trying to get the prince to give them the thumbs up.
Well, there's so many kind of variations of that tales of I will cut off my toes to fit into the slipper, but how is that different than what women used to do if they would literally have a rib kind of removed to make the corset smaller so you could fit into these kind of vessels of beauty?
Binding feet in China.
And binding feet. And, you know, raising my daughter, I really am concerned about what kind of ideals of beauty she internalizes, and to be healthy and to not be willing to do that to herself.
Holding the Rock, Ticking Within, Alice in Wonderland reference or no?
No, but I like it. I think that's great. You know, one of the really references that I ended up loving, because as I go back to these, is that crocodile in Peter Pan with that ticking that's coming after you, that time is just relentlessly pursuing you. I have so much more sympathy for Captain Hook now. This idea that, you know, time is pursuing him and he is getting older, and yet he's around these boys who are always young. How frustrating that must be.